Radio, and here we go. Welcome to another edition of We Talk Music. We've got an extra special guest. Besides you, Mo, you're not the extra special guest in this case. Neither am I, Brett. But we have our guest is the guitarist from Keel, Cold Sweat, Medicine Wheel, Mark Ferrari. How you doing, sir?
Hey, you missed Wayne's World.
That's true. That's true. We totally missed Wayne's World. What is it? Crucial Taint? Taunt?
Crucial Taunt, yes.
If it was Crucial Taint, I think we'd all be happier.
Maybe that would be a totally different movie. But
but thanks for having me. It's nice to be here with you guys and chat it up a little bit.
That's right. Well, we are very happy to have you on. You know, it's interesting. I've got a lot of questions to kind of, you know, a lot of like seemingly random things because, as I told you on the, you know, in our emails, we're working on a graphic novel. So a lot of what we're doing is trying to kind of get almost stories and feelings and kind of really like get into the nuts and bolts of some things.
And some of the things that are more difficult to find out about, like, you know, what it's like to be on tour, the daily grind of on tour that people don't necessarily always talk about. And, you know, what's it like to be on the bus with the other guys? Is it, do you go stir crazy? Is it creative? Is it, what's kind of the atmosphere? I don't know, I'm Canadian, however you want to pronounce it.
I say atmosphere, and I'm Canadian too.
By the way, I'm glad I'm talking to a couple of Canucks here because, I'm actually from the Buffalo, New York area, and some of my early exposure to hard rock was through Chum FM, which came out of Toronto, and I got exposed to so many bizarre underground Canadian metal bands. There's a lot of them. I mean, you know, we all know about Rush and Triumph, but like I was into bands like Moxie and Gatto and the Mad Cats and Max Webster, which really didn't hit here in the United States, but of course, Kim Mitchell and Max Webster were huge in Canada for a while. And just all these other, you know, kind of under the ground Canadian bands that were really helped form, you know, my musical background, you know. So I don't even know if you guys know some of those bands I just mentioned
because they're
all like 70s. But,
well, absolutely, we do. And of course, a friend of the show, Brian Vollmer from Helix, I know that you toured with them.
Yeah, we toured with them in '85, and I've seen the Helix guys on a couple of the cruises. I don't think Brent's out with them anymore, but I used to hang out with Brent. But I don't think he was in the last lineup that couple years ago. But Brian, I've hung out with a couple times on the cruises. I think he actually came up and sang the Right to Rock with us one or two times.
Oh, that'd be great.
That would be awesome. But, yes.
Well, he did. So I think there's some video out there of him. but anyways, a little tangent on my exposure to Canadian rock music. You know, I could rattle off about two dozen Canadian rock bands that most people would never have even heard of here in the States. But anyways, what are we starting out with here? What did you want to...
Yeah, I'm just kind of, what's the grind like when you're touring? What's the, you know, what's the tour bus like? Is it a creative environment? Is it, what's that like?
It can be. It can be. We had a portable four track cassette player with us, and I had built this little mini studio with a drum machine and a Rockman, you know, for my guitar and the four track. And I remember that we used to work on songs, you know, on those long bus rides from time to time when we weren't recovering from the previous night's activities. But you mentioned the word grind, and it certainly can be on a long tour, which is out there for, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks at a time. And you're in close proximity to not only the guys in the band, but we used to have our crew guys with us on the bus too. So you start talking, you know, 10, 12 guys on a bus, and it certainly, you know, it can try your patience and everything else. But, you know, touring... A lot of times, and I talk about this in my book, Rockstar 101, which I put a little plug in. I don't know if you guys have read it or even know about it, but
totally have. Yeah, I'm working on it. I haven't finished it.
Yeah, no, I talk about that very thing that, you know, sometimes the concept of a day gets blurred because, you know, if you're playing, especially if you're headlining, if you're headlining, you don't finish till 1 o'clock in the morning. By the time you get out, you know, on the bus, it's 2 o'clock, 2:30. By the time you roll out, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, usually somebody wants to eat, so it's stopping some greasy spoon at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then driving, you know, could be up to 10 hours or so, and getting into the next town, and depending upon if you're leaving that next day or not, you know, not getting a hotel room, just staying on the bus and not getting a shower. So it can be a grind, you know, especially for up-and-coming bands that, you know, don't have individual tour buses or they're not flying in between gigs. You know, it can certainly be a grind, you know. But that being said, that's just part of the game, you know. And I always thought touring was like one part being in the circus and one part being in the army and one part being in a loony bin, you know, because it was a little bit of everything, you know. But certainly a long tour can get grinding, and you know, especially if there's a lot of travel in between, not a one night stands. Now, we were out with Bon Jovi in the summer of 87. You know, we were doing multiple nights in the same town, three nights in Boston, three nights in New York, three nights in Jersey, three nights in Maryland, you know, and so then it becomes a little easier where, you know, you have a place to stay in between gigs and you're not traveling. So that was luxurious for us, not having to, you know, get on the bus after every gig and leave.
So what else did you used to do on the bus then, besides, you know, occasionally write and stuff? Were there like video games, or was it TV, kind of?
Video games and VHS. I don't even think we had DVDs. We're talking like 85, 86,
that's right.
Not even sure we had DVDs. It was VHS tapes. It was reading, you know. Obviously, this is well before the internet and everybody having cell phones and Wi-Fi. All the buses now have Wi-Fi. You might as well just have your own movie theater in your bunk, you know. And a lot of the buses now, they have individual entertainment systems in the bunks. We didn't have that. We had, you know, one lounge area in the back, you know. So, you know, I used to read a lot. You know, I certainly used to look where I was, you know. We sometimes travel through some nice parts of the country, you know, mountainous areas. But, or you'd be just playing stupid, silly games with each other, you know, just to pass the time.
You just screwing with each other, a lot of practical jokes and that type of thing?
Yeah, exactly. You'd be farting in somebody's face. Stupid stuff like that. Yeah.
That's still funny. I don't care what anybody says.
Now, when you were on tour, I guess, how did you get breaks a lot, or was it pretty consistent?
Well, let's see. You know, there were some tours that did have a little break in them, and then we would continue on. Like, we would do 2 or 3 weeks, take a week off, or we would go do our own thing for a week and then rejoin the tour. So there was some of that. I can't recall which ones in particular. I mean, you're asking me to rewind the clock back 31 years here. But there were a couple times I remember that there were, you know, little breaks in the tour.
How about those previous night's activities? Do you have, what were those like? With, you know, whatever you want to share.
Well, let's just say it was a good time to be a young guy in the 80s and being in a band. You know, it was pre, you know, it was pre-AIDS, you know, and, it was a party every night. You know, you roll into town and those people are, you know, I've been waiting to see you, you know, they make their own parties. What can I tell you? You know, people would wind up on the bus with us if we were just hanging out. We would go to clubs sometimes afterwards. So yeah, we definitely, you know, we weren't choir boys, but we weren't, you know, we weren't the worst of them either. But I think it's safe to say each of us in our own way was enjoying life at that point in time. You know, some of the guys in the band were married and didn't really mess around too much. I was actually dating the other guitar player's sister, at the time. I was dating Brian's sister, so you know he'd be watching me like a hawk.
So,
And you know what can I tell you? I you know like I said, I enjoyed life back then, and if somebody was you know there's an old expression, if trouble invites itself, it's usually easily accepts it. So I got into, you know, I got into some minor trouble, but nothing major back in those days.
so when you're drinking and partying and that's the lifestyle, is that does that on tour kind of is that what feeds you to some degree? Is that actually part of the grind?
Well, first of all, you know, what everybody's tolerance for drinking and drugging is different. You know, I was not, I didn't smoke pot. I wasn't really into coke back then. I couldn't afford it. Yeah, it was around. You know, I did it once in a while, but you know, I didn't, of course, get interrupted here. It wasn't really an issue with me. But I like to drink. I was a beer guy, still am for the most part. And but you know, I kept my drinking under control. You know, I never had my drinking never impacted my performances or anything like that. And but I guess it was kind of acceptable behavior back then to you know, to party, you know, for lack of a better word, to you know, that's what it was back then.
So speaking of performances, what's the dynamic like working with a second guitarist? Because I know for you in Keel, it was Brian Jay, of course, and I watched a video of from 2008 where you were on stage in Vegas, and Keel had two guitarists, so you were a third in that case. But what's it like in that dynamic?
Well, I've always been a fan of two guitar bands, you know. As a matter of fact, I've always been in two guitar bands. Even going back to high school, you know. I don't think I've no, I can tell you that I've never been in a band where I was the only guitar player. And I guess I always thought the guitar, you know, such an expressive instrument, and that when done right, two guitars complement each other. It's you know, my favorite bands growing up were, you know, mostly two guitar bands, you know, whether it well, there was a combination of both, you know, Kiss, Led Zeppelin, and Aerosmith. You know, well, I guess Kiss was a two guitar band, but Led Zeppelin was a one guitar band, Aerosmith two guitar, Thin Lizzy two guitar, AC/DC two guitar, Judas Priest two guitar, UFO one guitar and a half. You know, Schenker sometimes had Paul Raymond on rhythm guitar. So for the most part, you know, I was influenced by two guitar bands, you know, and always been a fan of dual harmony work, and that's Thin Lizzy was a real big influence on me. So I'm more comfortable playing with another guitar player.
Now, is there ever a moment where you're kind of scrapping over who gets the solo, or was that, or is that just kind of organic?
Well, in Keel, it was thought out because Brian and I are very, very different players. You know, I'm a blues bass player, come from the East Coast, you know, influenced by a lot of the guys I just mentioned to you. You know, Brian, West Coast guy, grew up listening to Randy Rhoads, Van Halen, George Lynch, you know, all those guys, Jakey Lee. And, you know, he's a West Coast shredder. So they're you know, I think our styles really complemented each other greatly. And if it was a real fast song that you know, required that over the top shredding kind of playing, then usually Brian was the guy. You know, if it was a ballad or something that required a more melodic solo, I was usually the guy. And I think I played the lead on all the Keel ballads, you know, going back to the one on Lay Down the Law, Princess of Illusion, and then Tears of Fire, you know, Because the Night, which is kind of a ballad, Calm Before the Storm. Those are all my solos, you know. But the real fast barn, you know, barn burning songs, you know, Fourth of July and Speed Demon, stuff like that, was Brian.
So when you're
So.
kind of creating a solo, then is it all something? Is it all feel? Is it all have to do with the song? Is there almost a psychology behind it? and you know, intellectual psychology behind creating it?
All I can do is tell you how I approached it. I always wanted to say something in my solos, and so I worked them out. You know, we used to have backing tracks, you know, when we were recording our songs, and usually the solos were the last thing to go down, or one of the last, the overdubbing process, especially if it was a dual harmony solo, it was definitely worked out. It wasn't something I just went in there on the fly and did. So I like to work my solos out. You know, I know other players are similar in that thought process, Michael Schenker being one of them. Read many interviews, you know, about him, you know, how he likes to spend time constructing his solos and going over them. He's probably a little bit more meticulous than I am, you know. Some guys just like to go in there and just hit the play button and just fucking go for it, you know.
Yeah.
And there might have been a couple of solos throughout, you know, my career in which that was the case. But for the most part, you know, I like to know what I was saying. It's like, you know, writing a speech, you know. You can go and write a speech and know what you're going to talk about, or you can go up there and wing it. So it's kind of a similar philosophy.
Yeah, Obama or Trump, really, I get it, yeah.
Well, I guess I was more of an Obama-type player.
Way to throw him off.
So now, did you, I guess, at what point then did you kind of know that you were done with bands and really wanted to move off on your own and like, just play for yourself, I guess, a little more?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
Well, when you got into doing the other music for, like, when you started doing the scores and the music that was the stock music and that kind of thing.
When the early 90s rolled around and there was a changing of the guard, very clearly there was, you know. The commercial metal guys had their day in the sun. And then in the early 90s, you know, obviously the Seattle movement came into vogue, and then all of a sudden, you know, instead of every band from L.A. getting signed, it was every band from Seattle getting signed, you know. And it was definitely a changing of the guard. And you know, commercial hard rockers like me, for the most part, were out of a job. You know, there were some bands that kind of were able to survive that period of time. You know, the Apex guys, Aerosmith, Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, you know, they seemed to survive. But for the most part, you know, most of the commercial hard rock bands either had a tough time or you know, just kind of gave up. In my case, don't forget, I had Cold Sweat after Keel, and that was 3 years of my life that were not the most pleasant, and the outcome wasn't what I had wanted it to be. And after that band dissolved, you know, I was just not sure that I had it in me to try to swim upstream and get another record deal in that environment and go through it again. And I was starting to make some great money by licensing my songs out to TV shows and films, and so I kind of viewed that as an opportunity for me to explore that path more, and you know, it was the right thing to do.
Now, I know that you had some difficulty there with Cold Sweat. I guess the band, when you're doing the album, the chemistry wasn't quite right and what you guys were looking to do. I would have thought that weren't you the most experienced guy? Would have thought that kind of would have been, I don't know, you would have had the lead on it, and it sounds like it was much more of a, I don't know, a fight to get the songs you wanted to do.
No, you are. I mean, obviously you are. You hit the nail on the head that, you know, I was the one that was the catalyst for that band. I put it together. I financed it. You know, my contacts got us the record deal and everything else. But, you know, I happened to pick some guys that happened to be very headstrong and very, very opinionated and, you know, just kind of fought me on a lot of different things. We chose our producer, Kevin Beamish, because we all liked a lot of his previous work with YMT and, to a lesser degree, REO Speedwagon. But the combination of him and a couple of guys in the band just kind of skewed it to being really, I thought, overproduced and really too slick and... I mean, there's some great rockers on that album, don't get me wrong, but it was a struggle for me because I wanted to keep it raw, you know. And So that's what happens when you have five chiefs and no Indians, okay? You know, you just got a recipe for disaster. And, you know, I can't blame all of what happened to Cole Sweat on the personalities of the guys in the band. We also, you know, we're on a label that was not the best rock label. Our timing, unfortunately, was, you know, we actually started recording that record a year prior, and had that album came out in 1989 instead of 1990, I think we probably would have done better, because by 1990, again, you know, there was starting to see a shift in playlists and everything on radio stations. But the whole Cole Sweat thing is, you know, obviously something that was a, you know, disappointment to me, because I put my heart and soul into it, and my my finances into it. Not that that should be the most important thing, but I think, you know, I think it was a really good band, a solid record, and I think it deserved to do better than it did. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's interesting, because when I, as I was looking at the pictures, you know, on your website through your career, and then you see the Keel pictures and you're off to the side, you see the Cold Sweat pictures, you're off to the side, but then you look at the Medicine Wheel picture and you're pretty much front and center. Does that kind of sum up the dynamic of those bands a little bit?
Well, I guess, you know, with Medicine Wheel, I wasn't the overbearing band leader, you know. Danny Gill was kind of my partner in that band. You know, we had three singers, as you know,
yeah,
over three records. Michael Mulholland was actually, you know, when I put the band together, he was the first piece of the pie, piece of the puzzle, I should say, getting the singer. And then, you know, Danny was second, and Danny brought in the bass player, and Danny brought in Ray Luzier. Ray's in Korn now, I'm sure, as you know.
Yeah, that's right. He was in, I know him from the DLR band, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, after my band, he was always doing projects. You know, he had three or four things going at the same time. But really proud of Ray for this amazing career that he's built for himself. But the Medicine Wheel thing, you know, it was a pretty collaborative effort, you know, and again, maybe it was because I was the most quote unquote famous guy in the band that, you know, people latched onto that. But matter of fact, the bass player, Robbie Harrington, went on to play with Keith Urban for almost a decade. So, you know, a couple of guys came out of Medicine Wheel and did some pretty amazing things after it.
You know, the story of how you got the name for the band Cold Sweat's pretty well known, but I always wondered actually how you got the name for Medicine Wheel, because I thought it was just a really cool name.
Well, I've always been very respectful and very intrigued by Native American culture, even though I'm not Native American, but I spent a lot of time in the Midwest on road trips, and I think it came out of that, you know, that I wanted to find a name that had some connotation or some relationship to Native American culture, and that's how we settled on that one.
Now, when you were doing songs for Master Source, I know one of the ideas was to try to do songs that you know had that sound of current songs. So, one of the things in my job, we actually use First Come, and so a lot of your songs come up on there, which I found awesome, and I try to use as many of them as I can, just because I really like that.
Yeah, he probably bought you a car or something like that. One of those exotic sports cars of yours. He's probably responsible for it.
But I got into, you know, we got into a conversation about how those songs get written, and like whether you're looking to directly copy or that kind of thing. So maybe you can break down that process a little bit.
I want to be very clear here that from the very first song I commissioned way back when I started Master Source to the most recent song, I'm still producing for First Come. So just FYI, when I sold my business to Universal in 2007, I stayed 5 years to run it for them. And then when I left, they took Master Source and they tucked it into FirstComp. So now instead of being, you know, a standalone music library that actually competes with FirstComp, it's actually part of FirstComp. So that's why you see the MasterSource stuff in the FirstComp library, because MasterSource is now a FirstComp sublibrary. But it's always been the case that I produce or commission material that's only generically similar to various artists. In other words, if I'm doing a pop rock CD, you know, we're producing stuff that sounds like it could have been from Justin Bieber, or it could have been from CO, or it could have been from yada yada. But you know, we're not ripping off specific melodies or lyrics. You know, we're just creating stuff that's in the same general generic ballpark. You know, that goes for all the different genres that we produce, whether it's pop or, you know, EDM, which is a little tougher because everybody uses the same fucking beats. And, you know, or whether it's blues or jazz or country or Latin or whatever it is, you know. We study what's on the charts, and then we produce music that's, again, just generically similar to it.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, some songs you hear and some of them are closer, but some of them you just recognize more of a vibe as opposed to anything
else. Is there any time based on that actually that you were doing a song for somebody, like you say, it's supposed to sound like this, it could come from this person, and then afterwards they have a song that comes out that kind of sounds like yours?
Possibly. You know, you throw enough monkeys in the room together, they'll type out the same thing, you know, eventually. That's the analogy that they use. You know, there's only 12 notes in Western music, you know, so eventually, you know, with millions of people writing millions of songs, it's only inevitable that, you know, somebody on you know, this side of the world will write something that's generic, you know, similar to something on the other side of the world. But I don't recall anything, you know, that you know, as you put it, that, you know, after we wrote something and somebody else came out and copied us, you know. We've never gone out and sued somebody else, and nor have I ever been sued for copyright infringement.
No, for sure. Now, I'm interested because, I mean, you've obviously done so well for yourself post-Keel and post Cold Sweat and Medicine Wheel. Has there ever been that desire to really, you know, form another band, go out on tour, and, you know, Weekend Warrior do it kind of thing, or is it just kind of, you're happy?
Yeah, I'm in a good spot right now with what I'm doing in my life and what I got going on, and, you know, Keel, until a couple years ago, was going out there doing, you know, 6, 7, 8 shows a year, which was enough to keep me happy. We actually haven't gigged in over 2 years, but we are on the next cruise going out next February, the Monsters of Rock cruise. I think that'll be our fourth one. So the answer to that question is no. I don't, you know, again, I'm kind of happy and content with, you know, the balance of what I have in my life right now. And I don't think that I'm missing out on something by, you know, not playing in a cover band or, you know, doing one of these all-star bands that seem to pop up every month. You know, there's always some kind of, you know, superstar band that's put together and shows up on either Rat Pack Records or Frontiers Records. I haven't felt the necessity to do that. That's just me.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think, you know, you must know pretty much everybody in the business at this point, it seems like. Danny Vaughn says hi, by the way.
I love Danny. He's a great singer. Like, we saw Ty Kettle on one or two of those cruises, and I really have forgotten how talented he is. And the drummer in Ty Kettle is the sister of a gal that I did a lot of work with, Michael Arbini. His sister Audrey was also in the same business as me, so to speak. So anyway, just a little side note there. But, you know, to answer your question, the short answer is no. I'm happy with my lot in life right now.
I know we don't have a lot of time. There's a couple things that I absolutely wanted to hit on. Just to go back to Cold Sweat for a minute. The cover to the album, Breakout, is, well, it's, I can't forget it. It's instantly memorable. and not like anything else. And yet, on the other hand, I don't really know what you were going for. How did the, what was the shoot like for that?
I mean, that goes back to the whole thing about MCA and their marketing department and everything else. You know, obviously it was supposed to play off the word sweat. You know, it was kind of like beads, you know. But I remember we got that album cover back and I'm going, what the hell? And, you know, literally, you know, their thing was take it or leave it. You know, we don't have the time. You don't have the budget to redo this, you know. You know, originally we were called Ferrari, and originally the Ferrari company was going to allow us to use the name in whatever we want. And then they came back and they said, okay, you can put it on, you can sell a record, you can call the band Ferrari, you can sell a record, but you can't put the word Ferrari on a t-shirt and sell it. So that's where the issue arose, and then we were trying to come up with a band name. As you know, it's like fucking, you know, hardest thing to do. And then, you know, we had the song Cry and Shame, and we all right, yeah, we like Cry and Shame, that kind of works. And then you know, it's getting closer and closer to release time, and there's only like these windows of opportunity to release the record. And then, you know, you have to do a trademark search, and trademark search comes up with a band called the Crying Shames. And so then it was like they had already started the logo. They came up with the interlocking CNS. We're going to use that for Crying Shame, and kind of like that. So then it was like trying to come up with a two-word name that had CNS in it, and that's when Full Sweat came out. And then again, we did a trademark search, and, you know, found out there was one mark was abandoned, and then there was a cover band using it. And anyways, you know, after the band was dropped, and we got sued by, you know, a cover band out of New York it was a cover band, and they weren't even original really. So it was just like, you know, the whole Cold Sweat thing was partly Spinal Tap, and just a kind of a big disappointment overall. So that's why I have no, you know, I keep getting asked to play live gigs with Cold Sweat. We have a standing, you know, offer to go on the cruise, but I just don't want to relive that part of my life. But the Cold Sweat record is coming out, being re-released by the way.
Oh, wonderful.
Excellent. So I was helpful with that, and I believe it's second or third quarter of next year. But, you know, I just, I'm the cog in the wheel on this one. Everybody would like to see Cold Sweat play again, and we actually came close to it a couple years ago, but I wasn't feeling it. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. I don't know if you know Derek Davis of Babylon AD at all, but we were talking to him recently as well, and he was telling us some crazy stories about different videos that that the record labels wanted them to do. And when I think of a crazy video, The Right to Rock is got to be up there. Yeah, tell me about that video.
That was, don't forget, that was, you know, roll that back, that was January of 85. You know, Twisted Sister, I think what the concept was to kind of, you know, back then a lot of videos had storylines to them. They weren't just performance videos, they had storylines to them, even Cinderella took that step after us. But I think you can go back and look at the success of Twisted Sister and their kind of storyline videos. And I think maybe that's kind of where some people thought we would benefit from that same kind of thing, that same kind of play, you know. But, you know, look, that video is still to this day, it's fun to look at, you know, it's fun to look at. And I think it conveys the message, you know, that we wanted to convey, you know, about fighting for your right to rock, that kind of thing. And, you know, I know it still gets a lot of rotations.
You know, it's got about 450,000 views on YouTube. And for those people, just so they know what we're talking about, it's essentially in 1989, I think that's the opening scroll, says that, you know, music basically, the law has shut it down, your right to rock. And then there's this kid with this video walking along, and perfect 14-year-old, you know, 1985 heavy metal kid, you know, and the police try and catch him, and he escapes and he runs away. And anyways, the police end up following him through the video. They end up at your concert where you guys rock so damn hard that those they basically electrocute and, I don't know, seem lobotomized at the end or something.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so great. And, you know, you look at the comments on it and some people are like, wow, I can't, oh, this is terrible. And then other people are like, if it was the '80s, if you weren't there, you don't get it. And the best person who said this video is rated FA for fucking awesome. That was my favorite quote.
That's great. You know, look, there's a lot of editing mistakes on there, and it's cheesy, and, you know, I'm sure we made it with a shoestring budget. We weren't getting Whitesnake or Aerosmith, you know, budgets back then, for sure. And we were, you know, we were a baby band on a small label, so we had to make the most out of it. Anyways, I'm not embarrassed by it.
No, I love it. I love it. I love it for what it is. It is what it is. And one other person said he really appreciates that you were fighting for his right to rock.
You know, and Ron actually was helpful with that whole PMRC thing. You know, he appeared on a couple talk shows with Gene Simmons, and I know he did some things with Dee Snider back then. So, you know, he was helpful in getting that whole thing done. So. Yeah. And that song was certainly, you know, one of those anthems that, you know, kids of the day, you know, they felt close to. You know, it said something to them.
Absolutely, and you know, actually, Ron in his book describes that song came together because I guess you were doing some sort of warm up and hit that. Is that how you remember it as well? That was it.
Oh, yeah, that's a true story. We were doing our first record. Up in Cotati, California, lay down the law, which in that studio, I think it's still there, Prairie Sun, is like on a farm. And you'd wake up and be a fucking cow. you know, it's true. But anyways, yeah, we were just doing we were just getting a level check, you know, and I just started jamming, you know, bang, you know. That's what I just kind of came out of me. And then Kenny, our bass player, just kind of came in and just roll tape. That was the first demo of that. Was really the, you know, the sound level check for, I don't know what song we were recording when we did that, but that's how that happened. So glad they hit the record button then.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I mean, I was thinking about how you guys did an album in 84, 85, or 85, 86, 87, 84 as well, right? So you did four albums in 4 years. That's a lot of.
Pardon? Technically, we did four albums in 3 years because we did two in 84. Lay Down the Law was recorded in June of 84. The Right to Rock in Right to Rock was in August of 84. The Keel album was actually recorded for the most part, 1986. We did four records in three and a half years.
And that's a hell of a lot of songs to come up with. So, you know, I mean, especially if you're not necessarily, if you are on the road, not necessarily writing that much on the road.
Well, don't forget, on The Right to Rock, we actually re-recorded three songs from Lay Down the Law.
That's
we
true.
We had three new ones, and then because we had to start that record so quickly, literally we had just finished Lay Down the Law like 8 weeks prior, and then Gene only had this narrow, you know, Gene committed to doing the record, and he was doing a movie. He had just this narrow window of opportunity to produce our record, so we had to go, you know. So we wound up recording three of his songs. So we could have used a little more time, maybe, to write more material, you know, for The Right to Rock. But it, you know, again, we had to take advantage of Gene's schedule.
You know, it's one of those things where I think about The Right to Rock, how that is your, like, you know, in many ways, the signature song for Keel, right? And it's something that you say you just kind of were jamming and it came together. And then I know that, you know, one of the reasons you left was, you know, the label, MCA, I think at the time, was pushing for you know, a real hit single. And that's when you were out with Bon Jovi and, you know, a keyboardist was brought in. And it's funny to me that, I don't know, it's great bands. I'm trying to think of was there ever a great band that thought to themselves, we're just going to write for, like, did the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Zeppelin, did they think, we're just going to write for singles? It's amazing to me that the record labels kind of don't get this.
Well, but again, you're looking at it through a rearview mirror. Because back then, getting on MTV and getting radio play was hugely important. You know, so And we were in the era of the power ballad, you know, and we were commercial hard rock. You sell millions of records because you appeal to a broader base of people. So I, you know, understand their position, you know, but I thought that, you know, the last Keel record had a couple of, you know, a couple of songs that were really pop, you know, could have been singles. I Said the Wrong Thing to the Right Girl, for example. I think that was a great song that should have been a single, never was. But, you know, record companies, they want to sell product. And by the way, they sell more product, you make more money. So, but in our case, I think we could have done that without, you know, bringing in a keyboard player. And that's where Ron and I had a difference of opinion. And I just didn't want to be the thorn in the side anymore. That's when I left.
You know, your book Rockstar 101, as we talked about it, is a guide, you know, for the you know, upcoming musicians in many ways. Do you think that you need to make an addendum or a new volume just because it came out in 2002 and in the last 15 yeah. years the distribution has changed and everything's changed for musicians much?
Absolutely. I don't know how much it even, you know, I haven't read it in a while, but I don't think it really touched upon most of the digital distribution things, this huge sea change that we've seen in the way music is distributed and consumed. So yeah, it should be updated, but you know, I'm not sure that it would sell that many more copies on an updated version. So we'll see. The publisher hasn't asked me to update it. Let's put it that way.
So yeah, I mean, you go from you know, like, trying to be a rock star and then trying to be a writer. So like, what are the differences and what are the similarities between, you know, trying to get something published and trying to get, you know, something recorded in that regard?
Well, there are similarities between the two, because when I wrote my manuscript, I didn't have a deal in place. I submitted the manuscript to many publishers, you know. It's kind of like submitting a demo tape, you know. You record something and you submit it and you get feedback and, you know, people like it or they don't. So it's the same way with the book, you know. I submitted it to a ton of publishers. You know, some publishers did not publish reference books, which that is. It's not a novel or anything like that. It's a reference book. Others had titles that were similar and didn't need another one, but, you know, I probably had 49 no's, but I had one yes, and that's all it takes. So, you know, as far as the process goes, in my case, I wasn't writing a fiction book. I was writing a reference book, so it's not like I had to come up with a story, which is more of a creative process. I had to just, you know, I just had to, you know, elicit my knowledge and take my knowledge and put it on, you know, in the written word, but I didn't have to come up with a story or a creative line or a story arc, you know, which is like what novels have to do. So it was a little, you know, a little different. I mean, there are similarities because it is creative. You are writing, you are going to that right side of the brain that where your creativity is housed. But again, because it was not a fiction book, it was a reference book, it was easier. You know, once I got going on it, you know, I went up to run out of cabin up in the mountains one that summer, and I wrote every day, you know, and it just kind of poured out of me.
You know, I look at the the title, Rockstar 101, A Rockstar's Guide to Survival and Success in the Music Business, and then you recently have a children's book that you've come out with here, which I just ordered through Amazon to bring. I have a 3-year-old in the family who I think will love it, and turning four soon. And I'm thinking,
well, that was about the age that my daughter started showing a propensity for procrastination, as I like to say. And that's kind of that spurred this whole second book, you know, I didn't think I was going to be a children's book author, but it just kind of happened organically. And my daughter, you know, kind of wrote the book for me, you know, because it really is kind of a semi-autobiographical take on what happened in our family on most days, trying to get her out the door when she was younger. She's much better now, but you know, sometimes even these days, it's tough getting her out the door. So I wrote the story for her, you know, kind of as a love story to her and for her, just to help her with time management. And then, you know, I started showing it to some friends, and, hey, this is really good, you know. And I read enough kids' books in my days to know that the story was just as good as most of the stuff that was out there at Barnes & Noble. So I decided to, you know, to craft it more into a full-length story. I think it's like 32 stanzas in there. And again, the process was similar. I submitted to a bunch of publishers, and they all say no except one, you know. And all it takes is that one to say yes.
And it's called Don't Dilly Dally Silly Sally.
Hey, right? You did it. That's impressive.
I thought I was going to screw that up for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I had blurted that out one day to my daughter. I don't even know where it came from. You know, because she was dilly-dallying. Don't dilly-dally, and the Silly Sally thing just kind of came out next to it. And that's, you know, lo and behold, you have a book.
You like long book titles,
I guess. I guess.
Can we talk a little bit about Wayne's World, man? I know that you got there because Penelope, is it Spheres? Yeah. Is that how you pronounce the last name? Because of your relationship with her. But I'm wondering did you get a chance to read the script ahead of time? Did you know what you were getting into? Were you a fan of the sketch?
I was a fan of the sketch. Yeah, I don't recall us getting the script. You know, most of the stuff, as you know, we were playing back to pre-recorded songs. You know, I was in her band, right? And so I think there were four, on Wayne's World 1, there were four or five songs that we, you know, for the most part, we were playing back to various scenes. I think one other scene in the, when we were shooting the video for Tia, you know, we were like walking, I remember. That's when we were in our loincloths, walking in our loincloths. But for the most part, you know, we were you know, playing back songs. I remember we did rehearse those songs on with Tia, you know. That's her singing, and it wasn't her playing bass, but that was her singing, for real, on those playbacks. But it was a great experience, you know. I had never been on a movie set before. Well, I take that back. We were on a movie set. Keel were extras on this movie that Gene was doing called Never Too Young to Die, which John Stamos and Vanity, and we were extras for like one day. I've never been involved in a studio film of that magnitude before, let's put it that way. That was a big production, for sure.
So, as you're watching it kind of unfold around you, how long were you on the set for, actually?
God, we were there all day. I mean, any day we were shooting, we were there all day. And as I'm sure you've heard from other people that work on movies, it's mostly hanging around doing nothing.
Yeah, hurry up and wait. So as you're sitting there kind of watching this movie unfold, are you thinking to yourself, yeah, this is a movie that just caught the zeitgeist of that time period so perfectly. You know, yeah. Did you realize that it was kind of going to work that way? Or are you thinking, oh, this is some crazy shit?
Nobody had any inkling that Wayne's World would be the highest grossing comedy of all time for a while. I don't think anybody thought that. I think people thought that it would have pockets of acceptance and, you know, certain appeal to a certain, you know, your Saturday Night Livers, you know, but it just blew up to be this whole cultural thing. And I can tell you that nobody was expecting that.
Nobody. You were on the set with Chris Farley, was one of the guys on the set with you, correct?
Yeah, on Wayne's World 2.
Yeah, Wayne's World 2. I just want to kind of ask a little bit about Chris Farley, because I just watched his documentary, I Am Chris Farley. And
I've been in World 1, but he was one of the roadies in Wayne's World 2.
Yeah, and he was, from what I understand, people always describe him, you know, like I say, just watch I Am Chris Farley, the documentary on his life, and they say he's the funniest guy ever, and he's the guy who didn't know how to turn it off, though. That was the difference between him and everybody else, was he was just on all the time and had to be funny all the time. Do you have any stories about him or any observations?
You know, I honestly don't. Not with him, because Wayne's World 2, we shot that Wayne stock scene. I think we were just there for 2 days. You know, and he was there, but I remember him being pretty well behaved. You know, remember, you know, like him destroying the set or anything like that, where he does on Saturday Night Live. You know, I think everybody was pretty well behaved on the set, you know.
So he never took his penis out to you.
No.
Apparently, that's something he loved to do.
Well, he didn't do it around me. So if he did it that day, I wasn't there to observe it.
All right. Well, I'll just ask you one last question then. So did Gene Simmons ever ask you to join Kiss as Ace Frehley?
No, back in those days, you know, I think it was right during the time, I think Mark St. John was still the guitar player when Gene was working with us. He, you know, Mark only lasted the one record, and then they got Bruce Kulick. Probably in 85 or 86, you guys would know more than me, but no. He never asked me to join Kiss. I wasn't tall enough.
That's the one funny thing about that video from 2008, with you and Ron, where it's like Ron is like standing behind you while you're soloing, and he's like got his head on top of yours.
I'm 5'8", Ron's about 6'3", 6'4", so it worked out just fine, though.
Awesome. Well, we have a tradition here, and we talk music, and we'll give you a chance to do it now. If you would like, it's a little segment we like to call Plug Your Shit.
Plug My Shit. All right, well, the only shit I can plug right now, I guess, is the kids' book that we just mentioned, Don't Dilly Dally, Silly Sally, available Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or actually through me at my website. If you send me an email, I will actually, you can buy it from me direct, and I'll sign it for you.
Ooh, I'm buying one.
Yeah, I'm gonna cancel my Amazon order and do that.
All right. You know, as far as other things that I got going on, Keel will be on the Monsters of Rock cruise in 2018. I think it's already sold out, though, or it's close to being sold out if it isn't already. But anybody wants to come hang with us, I'll be there.
We want to hang with you, but we can't make it for the 2017. So please go back for 2018.
All right.
Well, 2019 it'll be, because
that's right.
Yeah, February, yeah. It's, yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, Mark Ferrari, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time, and we wish you the absolute best in the future with all your endeavors and all your mountains to climb.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Mark. And Mark, we're going to call it to you. We have a song that you would love us to put on at the end. It's kind of something we can get your permission for. I think that would be good.
What, a Cold Sweat song or a Keel song?
Whatever you like. Whatever you think would be appropriate.
Well, you could go with Cold Sweat from Thin Lizzy, which was the song that kind of inspired us to name the band Cold Sweat. I always love that song.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Big thing, right. Thin Lizzy thing. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Stone cold sweat, stone cold crazy, place another bed.